Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program.
Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, a request submitted to the guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here in KiteLine, we hope to share these messages with you across the prison walls.
A call-in has been organized by supporters of the imprisoned New African Black Panther, Kevin Rashid Johnson. Johnson, who is confined at the Clements Unit in Amarillo, Texas, has been vocal about the mistreatment of prisoners and has served as a witness in cases investigating the misconduct of prison guards. For this reason, he has become the target of violence and abuse at the hands of several guards in his unit. After threatening Johnson with violence if he did not learn to, quote, mind his own business, unquote, Captain Patricia Flowers confiscated most of Johnson's personal belongings from his cell, including his books and important legal materials that are relevant to his case and those for which he serves as a witness. Later, when Johnson asked guards about the personal property that had been taken from him, he was verbally abused by Sergeant Arlene Walk and then sprayed with chemical gas by guard Andrew Leonard. Several witnesses, including at least one guard, have confirmed that Johnson was handcuffed inside of a locked cell when he was sprayed with chemical gas. He was then denied medical aid by the nurses on his block. To add insult to injury, he was not given access to a shower or clean clothes and sheets, so he continues to be subjected to the toxic gas contamination in his cell. In a statement released by Johnson himself, he says, quote, "While I need all possible support, aid, and exposure in response to these abuses against me, I am not and won't be deterred in continuing to shine a much-needed light into these dark and corrupt institutions. Dare to struggle. Dare to win. All power to the people." Unquote. To support Kevin Rashid Johnson, please call Warden Kevin Foley at 806-381-7080. Demand that his cell be fully decontaminated, that his personal property be returned to him, and that his abusers, Patricia Flowers, Crystal Turner, Arlene Walk, and Andrew Leonard, be sanctioned to the fullest extent possible. Organizers also ask that you stress the importance of protecting witnesses and whistleblowers from future violence. A riot at a prison in the Brazilian city of Manaus has left nearly 60 inmates dead. The riot occurred during a time of heightened gang tension and extreme overcrowding in the prison, which confined three times as many prisoners as allowed by its official capacity. The siege lasted 17 hours, during which inmates took hostages, including 12 correctional officers, who are employed by a private contractor that manages prisons throughout the Amazon. Officials are comparing the scene to one of slaughter, documenting decapitated and dismembered bodies being thrown over the walls of the prison. The riot has also reminded many of the 1992 uprising in Sao Paulo, when 111 inmates were killed as police forces stormed the building. Similar uprisings are anticipated to continue in the future as Brazilian prison populations steadily increase as a result of mass incarceration for minor drug offenses. On the morning of Thursday, January 5th, Panayota Rupa was asleep in a suburb southeast of Athens, Greece, where she has been living under an assumed identity when the anti-terrorism police burst in. She surrendered without a fight. Her six-year-old was taken into protective custody. Greek officials called Ms. Rupa, age 47, known by her nickname Pola, the country's number one most wanted terrorist. With her partner Nikos Maziotis, she was a leader of Revolutionary Struggle, which carried out a string of bombings and shootings targeting the police and others starting in 2003, and fired an anti-tank grenade at the United States Embassy in Athens in 2007. The attacks caused several injuries, but no deaths. Ms. Rupa is to stand trial on two sets of charges, one for violating the terms of her release from pretrial detention, the second for her involvement in the 2014 car bombing. The police said they were also looking into the possibility that she had robbed banks. According to her lawyer, Ms. Rupa has accepted responsibility for both crimes. He said, quote, "She is planning to assume complete political responsibility for her actions, but she is demanding that her child is given to her mother and sister," unquote. Her lawyer also said of Ms. Rupa, quote, "Given her social action and the fact that she is an urban guerrilla fighter, it is my great honor to represent her," unquote. Ms. Rupa's sister, Christiana, read a statement from Ms. Rupa in which she pledged to be, quote, "an unremorseful enemy of the system until I die," unquote. The statement added, "We are at war. This is a fact." It is also said that she would go on hunger strike until her son was turned over to her family, concluding that she would, quote, "remain their enemy until I die, and they will never break me."
This week, we return to the topic of pregnancy in prison. In episode 21, we spoke with Dr. Alicia Suarez, a sociologist who's researching pregnancy in the Indiana Women's Prison. Now, we return to the discussion and focus on the process of childbirth in prison. Later in the episode, we speak with Joe Knepp and other members of Stepping Stone's Baby Ministry, based out of Odin, Indiana. First, here's Alicia speaking to us about the process of giving birth while incarcerated.
A lot of them feel okay about the care they're getting from the midwives in the infirmary, because again, they come in and do prenatal care. They're taken out for ultrasounds. I think it's typically just for the anatomical scan at about 16 to 20 weeks, where they can sex the baby, but then they can also do all the measurements to make sure. And they typically will get a couple pictures, which are really special to them, and it makes their pregnancy feel somewhat normal to have the little ultrasound pictures. They're taken to the hospital in Anderson, and some of them are very humiliated having to walk through the hospital. Sometimes, especially when they're getting there for labor and delivery, they're taken in through like kind of a back entrance or something, which they appreciate when they are taken in that way. In terms of hospital staff, as a whole, most of them are fairly happy with the care they're getting at the hospital. A lot of the women that I've talked to are getting induced at 39 weeks. The good news is that we're not inducing before that now, because ACOG, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, have now mandated that you can't induce before 39 weeks, which is great, right? And they're following that at the prison. It's convenient to induce, right? The other reason, my guess, is why there's high rates of induction. And again, when I say high rates, that's based on my very limited data, you know, so it's not at all representative. I don't know what the patterns are as a whole, but my hunch is that if women have precipitous labor, if they go into labor naturally and they have quick births, they're going to have to go to a hospital in Indy that's not contracted, so it's going to cost more. So that's my hunch about why they're doing more inductions, is because if I'm inducing you, you're not in labor, I can safely get you over to Anderson. And if I let you go into labor and it's fast and you're all of a sudden in transition, I've got to get you to, I think they go to St. Vincent's, and that's going to cost a lot more. So we want to try to avoid that. So when women do go into birth, because certainly a number of them, you know, spontaneously go into labor, this becomes really tricky in terms of talking to the guard and telling them that you're in labor and you need to go to the infirmary. First of all, let's just even imagine having to go tell a male guard what your body's doing and why you need to go to the infirmary, okay? This person who has power over you, right? So that's just one thing. In national data about, you know, satisfaction with healthcare, a lot of women who are incarcerated critique in-house healthcare providers, more so than the healthcare they're receiving on the outside. They tend to be much more critical of healthcare providers within the prison. And so I've heard some stories and read some stories about women who convince the guard that they need to go to the infirmary. They get to the infirmary. They're sometimes put on the monitor, and then depending on what the monitor says, they may stay there or they may be sent back to the dorm. I've heard a number of stories of women being told, you're not that far along, you need to go back to the dorm. For some women, that's happened like back and forth over several hours or a day. Like going to the infirmary, being told, you're not far enough along, you're fine, go back to the dorm, you're not really in labor, it's Braxton Hicks, et cetera, et cetera. They can't be told when they're going to be induced, because that could be a flight risk. Because then I could call my husband or my mom and say, they're taking me to the hospital on the 4th. So you meet me there and we'll make a run for it. And it used to be at times, and at different prisons it's different, that you could have a family member meet you at the prison and be with you while you're in labor. That's no longer the case at the IWP. When it was the case before, you had to be married to that person. So if you were just partnered, they weren't allowed to come, which is interesting on numerous levels, right? In terms of heteronormativity, etc., and just ideas about what's appropriate behavior. So a lot of the women, they're woken up in the middle of the night. they're taken to the infirmary. Sometimes they're in the infirmary for several hours until there's two guards available to drive them to Anderson for the induction. Depending on the guards, they may be talked to while they're transferring. Maybe not. Sometimes the guards just chat, listen to the radio. Sometimes the guards are like, how you doing back there? Are you okay? More typically, they're ignored. So they're on a bumpy ride for an hour. What, sometimes they're not in labor, though. They're going to be induced. But then sometimes when they're in labor and deemed it's slow enough that they can make it to Anderson, they're still in labor, immobile in a car for an hour or in a van. Once they're at the hospital, the medical interactions are fairly standard. Do you know what I mean? I'm not hearing anything that's like, whoa, that's weird. I don't know that it's that different than what women in any hospital are getting. They all tend to get an epidural. I have interviewed a couple who did not. Most of the women have wanted it. The thing is, too, is one of their legs is handcuffed to the bed. They take the handcuffed off during pushing. I would sure as hell get an epidural if you had me chained up. I mean, the only way I did natural labor is because I moved around and walked around and squatted and this and that. The women, I mean, again, it was like maybe two or three who did not have epidurals. I'm just in shock that you would labor naturally while being handcuffed to a bed and having no support except for the nurses coming in intermittently. Some of the guards talk to them. Some of them don't. Some just sit and watch TV. Some don't let the woman even choose what's on TV. And being able to choose what's on TV is kind of like, especially if you don't have a TV in your room, like kind of a big deal. So that's something interesting. And some literally don't talk to the women at all. Some of the women talk about just sitting there crying while they're in labor. None of them describe being in labor in the prison as a positive experience. And not because of the hospital. Just because they're alone and they're scared and they're sad. Because for many of them, they're going to have to leave their baby there. The good thing is most of them are getting skin to skin, which is pretty cool. I've been asking a lot of the women, like, whether they're being encouraged to breastfeed or not. It seems like most of them are. A lot of the women are choosing not to. One woman told me recently, well, they told me I couldn't breastfeed because I had hepatitis C, which is absolutely inaccurate. Women with hepatitis C absolutely can breastfeed. So I thought that was really upsetting to me that she missed an opportunity to give her baby colostrum because she was told she couldn't do that. Now, again, I don't know exactly who was telling her that, but that's her perception. Most of the women are pretty happy. I mean, I had one woman the other day say, I was so happy that it was the midwife that I'd been getting care from, and it was really nice to see her face. And others talk about the nursing staff and how supportive they were. But again, nursing staff is overstretched, and they're not able to, like, hang out in the rooms. They're overseeing so many patients, so it's just like popping in every now and then. So women who have a vaginal birth and who are not bringing their baby back to the IWP have 24 hours in the hospital with their baby. So a number of women tell me about how they stay awake the entire time. And even worse is when some of their babies end up in the nursery for some reason. And so they can only go down to the nursery to see their baby. And that's limited. And they get 2 days if they have a cesarean. So some women are like, I'm glad I had a cesarean, so I got 2 days. You're glad you had major abdominal surgery. That's profound. And depending on the guards and when their shift change, sometimes they'll get a different guard who's like super cool and super sweet. And there have been some stories about guards being really supportive while the woman was in labor and like holding her hand. And there's been other stories with the guard immediately saying, don't expect me to hold your hand or anything. So it's a crapshoot in terms of what guard you get and your relationship with that guard, in terms of kind of what that experience is going to be like. There's also an armed guard outside your room for flight risk. And I have heard stories of guards being actually very caring and empathetic, but there's no consistency. It's totally discretionary. They're essentially not supposed to be very empathetic. In a national data, most women's babies go to a family member. So most women absolutely want to avoid their baby going to the state. I don't know the rates for the IWP in terms of placement, but a lot of women want the baby to go to a family member. A lot go to their mothers. A lot of mothers have their daughters' babies. Some of them it's their grandmothers, depending on how young the mom is. Sometimes it's with the dad. That tends to be less common. Typically that happens when the woman's own immediate family is, she's estranged from them. And they're like, we're done with you. Typically what I've found is some of the women's kids are already, they've already lost custody, or their children have already been living with their mothers or another family member. So sometimes that family member's like, I already have two of your kids. I can't take a newborn. So this is a big issue of finding, you know, where to put the baby. I mean, obviously you can just give the baby to the state, but there's another option, and this is really fascinating. There's a group called Stepping Stones.
Earlier this week, we went to the home of Joe and Amanda Knepp, who founded Stepping Stones, a program that fosters babies born to mothers serving time in the Indiana Women's Prison. That day, we also met Mercy, a year-old baby who's currently part of the program, and you can hear her cooing in the background throughout our discussion. I'd also like to thank Joe and Amanda personally for inviting us into their home to help us understand more about the program and its relationship to the Indiana Women's Prison.
It's called Stepping Stones Baby Ministry, and we got our idea from an organization that's something very similar other than a little bit different in Colorado, which they take their babies and put them in homes, and then they have nannies. Here we actually take the babies and place them in homes where the caregivers actually live. Now the IWP, if there is a lady that is expecting and she goes to prison, they go to the Indian Women's Prison. And then if they do not have no place to go with their child other than the Child Protection Services, then we will take that child under, just it's just voluntarily, and place it like we did this one. If that mother there is going to be released, what, in 5 years now?
2023.
2023 she gets released. And we pick them up at the hospital when the baby is 48 hours old after they sign a power of attorney paper. First of all, they fill out an application, sign a power of attorney paper, and then we go up, if we have the time, and interview with the inmate and assign a caregiver. If it works, we actually take the caregiver up for a visit before the baby is born. But sometimes we do not have the time to do that. After the baby is 30 days old, we take it up for a visit once a month. And then if they have special things going on, we also take them up for that. And then we as an organization, we actually go up usually. The last 2 years, it's the same weekend as the Indianapolis 500, and we go up for a cookout. We fix hamburgers and hot dogs and fry pies and potato chips and soft drinks for all the inmates and all the staff. It took us a little while to get into that, but they allow us to come up for church services once a month also. And that's the fourth Sunday. So it has been a real blessing to us. We actually have got a list of people that sign up, like Marge did here, that, hey, whenever my time comes, I would like to have a little baby. And then if there's times that if it don't fit, we might go to the second one in line or something. But yeah, most usually we just take them as they come up then, and then when the baby goes back, they'll call and say, hey, put me back on the list. And we probably got a list of, what, 10 or 12 people waiting, families waiting in line for little babies. The only time we adopt is if the birth mother says, and usually this is the words that they use, I cannot give that child what you're giving it. Would you be willing to adopt? And we have had 5 adoptions out of those 39, and there's 3 in the progress of being adopted.
Okay.
We tell our caregivers, you cannot say nothing unless they bring up the subject. Then we are willing to talk, if the caregivers are willing to take the child, which they are. And it is very difficult. I mean, we've actually had some that had signed up, and they took care of a child, and the child goes back, and that's difficult. Part of your life, the one was just, what, 3 days? she was here for 3 days, and then mom decided that that's not what she wanted. You know, and it's really difficult, you know, to see that child go back, but that's what we agreed to do. The birth mothers of the children that we take care of, when they get released, then the baby goes back. Well, then they're no longer in there to tell the others, hey, I got my child back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're giving their children to complete strangers. They don't have time to talk to the ones that have got our, have the birth mothers that we are taking care of their children, and it just, yeah. It was very difficult to get started. I mean, we was complete strangers to the superintendent there. I worked on it for, 2 years? I just felt like it would have been nice for the community to have one here, and it has really blessed us. Usually, the time that we have these babies, we pick them up when they're 48 hours old, and then before they're 16 or 18 months old, they actually go back to the mother. So that's very young. We actually have also got a house in here at Odin, what we call the aftercare. If there has to be a transition, we'd like for the mothers to come down, and then the babies can be with the mother and the caregiver. We'd like to see it where they have a little bit of a transition so it's a little smoother. It is really hard on me, and it is hard on some of the caregivers. They will sign up for one, and when they get done, I cannot handle it. We'll never do another one. Then there's others, they're just made for it. And, you know, we tell our caregivers, is that, you know, what you're doing for that child, that's what you have to remember. You know, what you start worried about what's going to happen to the child when it leaves because you've got feelings for it. It's very difficult. And others take it really well. One thing we ask from the birth mother is when you are released, we would like to keep that relationship open. But some of them, when they get the baby back, we don't never see nothing of them no more. But some of them, they do. We've actually, one of these three that's in for adoptions right now, her mother has actually been out of prison for a year and a half. And finally she just said, hey, you know, are you willing to adopt? We have got a very large community. The babies in our community are very special. When it's a baby from the prison, everybody wants to hold it. I mean, it's special. The dad of the babies, when if the baby is born when the mother is incarcerated, that name actually is not on the birth certificate, on any birth certificate. They do not, state does not allow them to do that. We do have some of our caregivers that communicate with the dad, even though we do not promise any visits. We did promise the birth mother that once a month or thereabouts, you know, 12 times a year, she would get a visit. But we do not promise a visit to the dad of the child. For a lot of those mothers up there, we are plan B. They actually, when they go in there, they have to have a plan in place that if she gets in trouble, we have time to go pick that child up. Sometimes it's 8 hours, sometimes 6 hours, a very short time. Mom had gotten in trouble, and if we don't pick the baby up, then it goes into Child Protection Services.
It's not just to make a difference in the child's life, but also in the mother's, because there's some reason why they're there. And they need love and support. So that's what we want to do. You just keep trying.
You know, even though we cannot teach that little child to stay out of meanness when it grows up, we can still lay a little bit of groundwork where we can help a little bit and have, well, you can tell that she's loved there. And I don't know where she'd be at. Some people would do it just for the money, and they're not doing it for that because they're not getting paid anything. We actually have got some families that would not take an African-American baby because in case it stayed. And then others, when there is one, they just want to have it. I mean, it's not our turn. You know, they want to have it. So it is not an issue it's not an issue, which I'm very thankful for that, that those are just a little bit, I mean, those are special too. We've had not a lot of those. Yeah, five or six probably have been African American, but it's not been, not saying it was like that to start with. We had some people that had to do a little bit of talking to help us out on that part, you know. But in the most part, I think most of the community is not got a problem with it anymore. We just started in 2010, so we're not what you call real old yet. I hope as time, if time goes on, these children grow up, that when they get 16, 17 years old, that we'll get to see them. We actually had a little stint with two, a brother and a sister, and those caregivers to this day are still in contact with them. And that's been, they've been back, what, 2 years? So, yes, that is working. Those caregivers was actually two sisters that was not married at the time. And they really got a good relationship with the grandmother and the mother. It's working out really well. And hopefully we'll have more to say about that here in 10 years from now, if time goes on.
You can send Stepping Stones a letter at P.O. Box 304, Odin, Indiana, 47562. This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at KiteLineRadio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512, or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, KiteLineRadio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening.